Thank you very much for this very generous introduction. And I'm especially grateful to the Fields Institute and to the Dean's Office for giving me support as a visiting professor here. And for this opportunity to spend half a year here at this thematic half-year program, touching both analysis and algebraic geometry. That is something that I've been working on in the last almost 20 years. And so today I'm going to speak on this topic, multiple ideal sheaves. It will be a series of three lectures. And I will tell you what multiple ideal sheaves are, and then tell you the applications to algebraic geometry and to analysis. So it's an interface. That means analytic methods are going to be applied to algebraic geometry in a new way, and also the other direction, that algebraic geometry will be used in PDE estimates. So it's a very unique situation that it has benefits in both camps. So in this lecture, I will start from the very beginning, introduce to you what multiple ideal sheaves are. And at this point, there are two perspectives. It's like two sides of the same coin. One perspective is from PDE. The multiple ideal sheaves identified the set of all jet directions where estimates for PDEs fail. And the other perspective is from a point of view of stability, which is a geometric concept. And the estimates, of course, try to estimate some object living somewhere, usually on a manifold. And if you want to look at estimates and say the estimates for the object fail, and you want to locate where it fails, or you insist on having the estimates and let the base or the manifold stretch or being squeezed. And then finally it becomes something else, and that is the notion of stability. The manifold suddenly jumps to something else at the limit. And we will illustrate by examples which guide the development of the theory. And then at the very end, we will start discussion on application of algebraic geometry, and which we'll do in the second lecture. So let's start out with the first perspective. What are multiple ideal sheaves? So look at the situation of a differential equation, where the unknown is u and the operator is L, and then L equal to F. And we want to investigate this by looking at weak solutions. So we take test functions, G, and try to solve this by taking the inner product. And the main point of this a priori estimate is to change this L to the adjoint so that the unknown u sits by itself. And then by risk representation, if you want to get u, it suffices to show that this linear map from L star G going to the right-hand side here can be extended to a bounded linear functional. So this is it. And of course, by Schwarz inequality, you could more generously demand that we have this inequality for all G. Then you can solve the equation. Okay. Now, it looks a very complicated way of getting this, but intuitively, it is rather simple. So this is not as rigorous as in the... Oh, I forgot. Hold on just a minute. So it is not as rigorous as on the other page. But intuitively, this inequality here simply means that L star, or the adjoint, is injective, which means that L is surjective, means that it's solvable. So this is a very intuitive way of re-expressing this inequality. And then this is for existence. But for regularity problems, when you want to solve PDE and you want to say something about regularity, you could formulate things in terms of a stronger norm. This is, for example, epsilon means that it's L2 for the root up to order epsilon instead of L2. Now, the method of multiple ideal sheaves tells you that if these estimates do not work, then you try to make them work by cheating a little bit, and you multiply whatever you want to estimate first by a function, which may vanish or even identically zero. If you multiply, the estimate holds, and the constant depends on F. And the set of all such multipliers form an ideal, and it's called the multiply ideal. And when you look at it as germs and look at it as sheaves, it will be multiply ideal sheaves. That's the name for the topic we are discussing. And so the main thing about this ideal is that it may have zeros. If it contains the function that's identically one locally, then you have the estimate already. So when it comes to the situation of regularity problems, the same thing. For example, the L2 estimate for derivative up to order epsilon instead of just L2, you could also multiply it by the multiplier and let the epsilon depend also on F. Okay, so they form multiply ideal sheaf. And this was introduced by Zhou Kong in 79. And this is a very important concept, as it's a real breakthrough in the theory of PDE, because instead of just getting estimates, you translate into something that is algebraic. So defining is one thing, but the main thing is how do you get something out of it? And the main idea is that you have the zero set and the vanishing order multiply ideal sheaves. As I said, if the function that's identically one belongs there, then estimate whole already. We don't need the sheaf. And the trouble is that we have zeros. And the idea of multiply ideal sheaf is the same as what is known as microlocal analysis. When you get ellipticity and so forth, you may not get it point-wise, but you may get it in some directions. So that means like blowing up. So a certain direction, you have such an estimate. And the jet means that it's not just one kind of blow-up, but you could keep on blowing up for a number of times equal to the order of the jet. So the multi-ideal sheaf correspond to sort of many levels of microlocal analysis. And we hope to get global conditions to make sure that these multiple ideal sheaves cannot exist except for the structure sheaf. So the goal actually is to get a nowhere zero multiplier so the estimates hold. And if differentiation of multiplier can yield another, then eventually after you define a number of steps, hopefully you'll get the identity. So the philosophy of the whole theory is that if you differentiate a multiplier in quotation good directions, so in the estimate there are certain directions that are already good, so in those directions there should be no multipliers. That means the multipliers in those directions should be just one because they are good directions. So that means that when you differentiate using vector field in the good directions, you expect to get from a multiplier another multiplier. Okay. Then, of course, it only means that you have good directions under control. How about the bad ones? But the main point is that the good directions, the bad directions are not integrable. You could keep on differentiating. Somehow you get back to the bad directions. For example, if you take the Lie bracket of certain good directions, you may not be inside the good directions. Okay, that means if you take differentiation in good directions two times, and then skew symmetrize, of course, it's still differentiating in good directions, you end up with the Lie bracket, which may be one of the bad directions. That's the point. That means that the good and bad division is not integrable. So that essentially is the philosophy of the theory. And this had its origin in Hermander's sum of squares. So for example, let's illustrate this. If you have an operator, for example, a Laplacian, this is essentially the sum of the square, even though I take the adjoint. The only difference is the zero order term or lower order term here. And so if you take this operator, if the vector fields are the coordinate vector fields, this is just the usual Laplacian. And if you multiply, if you have L equal to V, if you multiply by U and integrate by parts, you get this, which means that the L2 for first order derivatives in the direction of Xj will be bounded. So you get some regularity, but only along the good directions. And then Hermann started this theory of looking at Lie brackets, the way that I was explaining a moment ago, that the idea is that that's not how Hermann did it, because the multiple ideal sheaf came up only after Zhou Kong, and this was way before that in 67. So nowadays, from the present perspective, the idea that it works is that when you have a multiplier, if you differentiate in a good direction, it's still a multiplier. So if you take the Lie bracket, then it's still there. So Hermann's result tells you that if you take Lie brackets the number of times iterated, eventually you generate a whole vector field and you have so-called sub-elliptic estimates. So now I want to look at another perspective. So the one that I just finished handles the situation which describes the failure of PD estimates, and then you identify the jet orders in which the estimates fail by multiplying it by something that vanishes in that direction. And now another perspective is the perspective of stability. So in applications, both will be used. Actually, they are two sides of the same coin, so the difference is not that much. Depends on whether you are focusing on the object you are estimating or focusing on the ground the object stands on. So when you look at geometric application, again, look at LU equal to F, and suppose this differential equation cannot be solved by the usual method, elliptic and so forth. You want to approximate this by making it better by a sequence of operators. And this is kind of technique that is used a lot in physics engineering. You add some friction term, the sum the sum of the derivative square and so forth, a small number times that, or you look at a heat equation or other evolution equation, say the Ricci flow and so forth, and you have the case of something approximating what you want. And suppose you could solve it at every stage of the approximation, and you want to say that the original thing can be solved. Then there's the question of compactness, and you take a Scoliazella argument, but that means that if you want convergence for a subsequence in a norm, you should have a bound for a stronger norm. And that is how the multiple ideal sheaf comes into the picture. So let's illustrate this. So you illustrate by looking at the simple case when the weaker norm is just L2, the square integrable, and the stronger one is L2 for the first order derivative. And if you change the scale, the usual L2 would be changed like this. But the L12 changes like this because of the derivative. So you see there's a different change of scales. So you could, by the change of scales, sort of normalize them, even if it's not bounded. But if you agree to normalize, you could make it bounded. So somehow they change it. Oh no, that's fine. Yeah. Okay. So if you are on a manifold, not in this special case, then if you want L2 for its first derivative, you would change the scale for every coordinate chart, and when the coordinate charts get smaller and smaller, and when the sequence approaches a limit, the scaling actually becomes a function. So that means that instead of estimating L1 for first, L2 for first derivative, you estimate after rescaling, which means after you use a multiplier. So the multiplier would be sort of the infinitesimal rescaling. So the two points of view are the same. So now I want to tell you what difference this makes. So if you insist on changing the scaling instead of adding the multipliers, what happens to the manifold? If you rescale the manifold will change. And when you get to the limit, the manifold actually collapses in this case. Instead of the object blowing up, you collapse the manifold. And so that is the unstable situation. So instead of the original manifold, when you get to the limit, if you normalize at every stage for the sequence, the limit would be something that is different. And the manifold is unstable, and the reason for this term is that you look at the moduli of space for the manifold. Before you get to the limit, even though you are rescaling it, it's still the same manifold. So that means that it represents the same point in the moduli space. But when you get to the limit, the manifold suddenly changes. So the limit actually belongs to the closure of the singleton, which represents the same manifold in the moduli space. So the moduli space, of course, is not Hausdorff, it's not even T1, if you use the notion of topology or Poinsett topology. And so the manifold changes, the manifold jumps, so the manifold becomes unstable. And where is the subspace? The subspace actually is very much related to the multiple ideal sheaf because it is to make the multiple ideal sheaf a unit that you collapse the manifold. So the subspace in which the manifold collapses actually is defined by the zeros of the multiple ideal sheaf. So the structure sheaf for the subspace is the structure sheaf of the original manifold over the multiple ideal sheaf. And if you look at it from this perspective, the multiple ideal sheaf also is called the destabilizing subsheaf. And this subspace, whose structure sheaf is the quotient of the original structure sheaf by the destabilizing ideal sheaf, would be called destabilizing subspace. It is the stabilizing subspace in which the original manifold collapses. So if you want to look at it from this point of view, then it would be a tautology to say that the PDEs are solvable if only if we have stability, if you formulate stability in that sense. Of course, it's a meaningless thing because you don't know when it's stable or unstable in that sense, because there are many senses of stability. And people always seek a good formulation, a global condition, to make sure that you can verify it. And there are cases in which this is known to be done, and we want to use those examples as guides to develop the theory in a more general setting. And what is known is the situation of Hermitian-Einstein equations for the metric of holomorphic vector bundle. So this is a misprint, this is a vector bundle, okay. This comparing the Chern class of any holomorphic subbundle with the original one. So the method of multiple ideal sheaves actually brings something really new. Before that, when people look at the best set, when you have estimates fail, they usually would do it in the sense of geometric measure theory, saying that the best set is small, the Hausdorff dimension is small, and so forth. And they do not take into account any extra structure that comes with it. But if you take the multiple ideal sheaf, the best set, of course, is a zero set multiple ideal sheaf, but it carries some extra structure with it. And you say, where are the extra structures? The extra structures are inherited from the ambient manifold, which collapses into the subspace. Because the original manifold, for example, has complex structure, and when the limit collapses and the substrate is not a submanifold, but still inherits some structure. And that is very important. And that's the reason why this method is far more powerful, because you use the last ounce of information available. So there's the question of inheritance of structures by the multiplier substrate or destabilizing substrate. And there are two ways so far in application such an inheritance is used. One is that the new structure satisfies certain differential equations. Say, for example, when you want to solve, as we will see later, the Hermitian-Einstein equation for a vector bundle, then if you have trouble solving it, the vector bundle collapses into a sub-bundle, which is actually defined by the multipliers on the total space. And then the original bundle is complex. And the main thing is that the sub-bundle into which it collapses also is holomorphic. So it collapses into something which carries the original structure. These structures are given by differential equations. For example, if you want to say that the new space has a complex structure, all you have to say is that d bar of the ideal belongs to the ideal tensor with 0-1 forms, like the Frobenius integrability statement. So certain differentiation works. Okay. So that's the situation of the structure inheriting some differential equation. Another is inheriting the solvability of certain differential equations. And we'll see this in an example to illustrate. For example, in a case so-called final manifolds, in which the anti-canonical line bundle is positive, then a cohomology of degree at least one with coefficient in the structure sheaf would vanish. And when it's collapsed, the destabilizing subspace also inherits the same property. The vanishing of cohomology simply means that the d bar equation could be solved. So it's inheriting the solvability of certain differential equation. So let me look at some examples. Actually, these are the original examples. There are two examples for the two perspectives. Where the multiplier ideal theory were first introduced. So let me look at one example, which is from the point of view of stability, is Nadel's work. And the setting is the following, that you have a final manifold, which is a compact complex manifold, whose anti-canonical class is positive. And you take a Kähler metric inside, and to get a Kähler-Einstein metric, one wants to solve a complex Monge-Ampère equation due to Calabi, and where f is the function satisfying the differential equation where the Ricci minus the Kähler metric is dd bar of the law of that. Okay. And so this is the equation of Calabi one wants to solve in order to get a Kähler-Einstein metric on a final manifold. So if you are able to solve it and take dd bar of the log, then this is the Ricci for the new metric, so this would be the new metric here. And the phi would be, dd bar phi would be the difference of the two metrics, and the f, by definition, if you take log and dd bar, would be the difference between the Ricci and the old metric, and this is the old metric, so you see that it goes back to the new metric, so it becomes Kähler. So that's Calabi's formulation. And the question is how to solve the equation. And the solution is by continuity method. So that is the reason why the limiting situation arises. So you want to solve this differential equation, and you want to introduce an additional parameter t So when t equal to 1 is the original equation, when t equal to 0 is known to be solvable, always. And so what you do is to look at the set of all t's for which it is solvable, and you want to show that this is a closed subset and open, so it must be the whole thing. So the openness comes up very easily because of the implicit function theorem. For implicit function theorem, you want to differentiate this respect to t, which is the same as linearizing it, and it becomes a Laplacian, and you can easily solve it that way. And the trouble is with closeness. So for closeness, you want to use a stronger norm so that you, when you get limit, you get what you want. Now, what kind of norms should you use? Here, actually, the unknown is the metric, and the phi is so-called perturbation of the Kähler potential. And the solution is phi. But what we need is actually the second derivative of phi. So you want convergence of the second derivative of phi. And a stronger norm would be like the third order derivative of phi. And it's known that the second and third order estimates hold. So what does it mean? The trouble is with the zero order estimate. For example, I gave a series of lectures way back in the 80s on this subject, and if you like, you could have a look at it. And if you want to use a Schottier-Stellar, you want to use a stronger norm than the second one, so you can use the third one, for example. And these two hold if the zero-order estimate is known to hold, and I'm not going to talk about it. But I want to talk about the zero-order estimate, which holds the key, because if it holds, then everything works. So look at the new metric. The new metric is in the anti-canonical class. And this class is fixed, and this is, of course, is positive definite. And it converges weakly because the total mass is bounded, because it's the same class. And if you take the average over x with respect to the original metric, then if you subtract this average from it, you can use the Green's kernel to solve for phi. You see, this one converges weakly. Its trace converges weakly. And the trace will involve Laplacian of phi. And you cannot invert it unless the integral of phi is zero. But you will subtract the integral of phi is zero. So you can invert by the Green's operator. And you invert by the Green's operator. Green's operator is compact with respect to two things. One is the mass norm here, one is the L1 norm here. So it converges to L1. So the zero order estimate holds unless this number, this average, goes to infinity as t goes to 1, for example. The sub norm is dominated by the average up to a constant because of the lower bound of the Green's kernel. Okay. Oh, let me see. So now, up to this point is sort of the motivation. Now here is the real thing, the point of debut for multiplied ideal shift. So we have trouble with this average. So we take this equation, we multiply by e to the power t phi hat. You get this equation. And the integral is the same here because they belong to the same class. And so this thing here, without multiplication, is constant. So if this thing goes to infinity, it means that this goes to infinity. So the trouble is that this thing goes to infinity along the subsequence. Okay. And now, of course, this part here, F determinant and so forth, is independent of T, so we don't worry about it. Now, the trouble is with this term, and that is the crucial estimate. The method of multiplied ideal shifts tells us the recipe. Whenever you get a crucial estimate and it fails, you stick in your multiplied ideal shift there to make it work. So here, even though the problem is differential equation, higher order and so forth, looks very complicated. But we know that it's always reducible to this crucial estimate. So the whole thing rests on this crucial estimate. And this crucial estimate is just L2. just L1. And so you stick in the multiple ideal shifts, so which means the rescaling, if you like. So if you do the infinitesimal rescaling to make sure that this thing works. And this is the notion of multi-ideal shift, and it's called Nadel's multi-ideal shift. This is not the way that Nadel presented it, but it's equivalent. So this is Nadel's multi-ideal shift, and to make things simple, let's call this different psi. So I want to emphasize one thing that involves a sequence. It's what I call a dynamic multi-ideal shift. It's not usually you want to stop an infinite process, a termination of some process, or limit of some process. So the useful part is always a sequence, a weight function here to do the job. And also it tells you how the base manifold collapses. So the other point of view is that the multiple ideal shift collapse, it makes the manifold collapse into the submanifold. And now you ask, how do you know that the manifold is stable in this sense? That means there's no destabilizing subshift, and we want some verifiable condition. Okay. Now, for a final manifold, because Kodaira's vanishing theorem, you have this vanishing. And as I discussed a moment ago, we are interested in the inheritance, whether the new subspace into which the original one collapses inherits certain properties. And of course inherits the final property, but so far there's no study about such subspaces, because final is usually for manifold, because it's an anti-canonical line bundle being ample. And of course you could develop more complicated theories for a final subspace if you can make some good sense out of it. But there are certain properties that go to the final, like the vanishing of cohomology, which we can formulate for the subspace. So we want to say that the subspace inherits this. Okay. And then you say, what is the use of it? Well, for example, if you know that the estimates work except for two isolated points or something, then you know that you cannot have two isolated points. Because the vanishing here means that the subspace cannot have two different components. Because if you have two different components, you will get a holomorphic function having value 0 on one component and 1 on another component. Because the vanishing cohomology enables to extend the constant function from the components. And that's a contradiction. So this is the kind of thing that one can make use of. Of course, this is not the only kind. And how do you know that the property is being inherited? So one way is to show that HP with coefficient in the ideal shift is zero. And this Nadel proof by showing what Nadel's vanishing theorem says, that instead of the Kodaira vanishing theorem, you stick in the multiple ideal shift. And of course, for the case L equal to minus K is the same as this. So, and you get the original thing by taking a short exact sequence and sandwiching it, no trouble. And in a special case, when you look at the proof, in a special case, when every psi nu is the same, then you get what I call a static multiple ideal shift, which is not useful for the original problem, but it's useful for application of algebraic geometry. So you could formulate this separately and say that when you have a compact complex algebraic manifold with a holomorphic line bundle with a metric e to the power minus psi, whose curvature current is strictly positive in the sense of current. That means it dominates some smooth, strictly positive 1-1 form in the sense of current. Then you have this vanishing theorem. And the multiple ideal shift is defined as the germs of holomorphic functions so that this is locally integrable, which is the original thing that we try to stick in the multiple ideal shift into the crucial estimates. Okay. So this separate formulation is the one used in application to algebraic geometry. is known as the vanishing field of Kawamata feedback NATO, because before NATO, or actually before Zhou Kong and so forth, I mistyped, this is 82. This was discovered in 82 by Kawamata and feedback separately in the algebraic setting. So this tells you that when you solve the Debye equation, the Debye equation is solvable if the right-hand side belongs to multiple ideal, and the left-hand side, the unknown, can be chosen to belong also locally to the multiple ideal. So now I want to give you another example, which actually preceded the NATO, but it was not cast in the language of multiple ideal sheaves, but I want to tell you how to interpret this in terms of multiple ideal sheaves. This is the work of Donaldson. You start out with the following setting, that X is a compact complex manifold with a Kähler metric, and V is a holomorphic vector bundle over X, and our job is to seek a Hermitian metric along the fibers. This is V. So there is Hermitian Einstein, also known as Young-Mills fields, which is a generalization of the Maxwell equation in the non-abelian case, in the SU2 case, in the U1. And it means precisely that the curvature, when contracted with respect to the Kähler metric of the base manifold, is proportional to the metric along the fibers. And for our discussion, we just drop the C and we just take to be 1, okay, just to make it simpler. So we want to solve this equation here. This equation is elliptic because you look at the omega, it's differentiating the unknown H alpha beta twice, and then you contract. So the unknown is a matrix unknown, but the equation actually is elliptic. Unfortunately, the usual estimates for elliptic equations apply only to scalar unknowns. I mean, those would involve, for example, the maximum principle or something. And so they apply only for scalar functions. For a matrix, doesn't work. And that's the reason why it's interesting to look at it in the situation of Hermitian Einstein matrix. Now you could regard this matrix as a scalar over the total bundle. Because what is a metric? Is you give me a vector, I give you a number. So it's a function on the total space. So if you consider the function of total space, which is, of course, quadratic along the fibers, it becomes a scalar unknown. But then you lose ellipticity because this is elliptic only because of the differentiation along the base manifold. And there's no differentiation along the fiber manifold, so you lose that. And then the multiple ideal sheaf comes in because you fail to have estimates. And now the idea of the multiple ideal sheaf comes from approximating operators. So you do it in the following way. You look at the heat equation. You seek a background metric, and then you use the endomorphism that transfer the background metric to the new metric, HT, and you take an evolution equation so that when it reaches the limiting situation in which this is stationary, it becomes zero, you get the trace proportional to the metric. So this is along the path of steepest descent to minimize whatever you want to be zero. Okay. So you introduce a multiple ideal sheaf, which is linear along V, where the varying metric blows up. So here the main thing is, as I said, that the differential structure of the original space gets collapsed into something. The original space is not the base manifold. The base manifold is fixed because you have ellipticity along the base manifold. So the multiple ideal sheaf shouldn't affect the base manifold. The collapsing is along the vertical direction because there is no ellipticity in the vertical direction to help you. So the bundle is where the scalar unknown is defined, and it gets the multiple ideal shape is there, and it collapses the total space into a subspace or a subsheaf, and the differential structure is preserved. So I'll say more about it later. And D bar, the ideal shape belongs to itself, tensor of 0-1 form. So you could make it holomorphic. Okay. Now, why is that the case? The idea is from the commutation. So if you have a local section of the multiplier ideal, you want to take D bar is still there. And the multiplier ideal is defined because the metric degenerates. Okay. So you take a section, if you compute its norm with respect to the metric, it goes to zero or something, it degenerates. Okay. You take D bar and you take the L2 norm, you can do integration by parts, and you take D bar and then you commute, and you get the trace. And the trace is bounded because you are actually looking at the equation that goes down by the path of steepest descent. So it is going to be bounded. Therefore, you end up in the commutation with the curvature times the S. So you take Hölder inequality, you will get the S norm square and it's bounded. Therefore, the D bar of S belongs there. It's just a matter of commutation. It's not complicated. And the stable destabilizing subbundle is spanned by the non-zero eigenvectors of H alpha beta bar. It's just the polar situation. You are defining it with zero, end up with the other part that is non-zero. Okay. Now, the original equation in the limiting situation is going to be satisfied. It means that the curvature contracted is proportional to the metric. But the metric degenerates. However, the curvature is still there. So if you take the subbundle, the curvature is going to be concentrated completely on the subbundle because the rest is zero. Okay. Now, when I write down C1, I actually means the number which is a product with the correct power of the Kähler curve. That means the contraction. But if you divide by the rank, then if the C1 of W is same as C1 of V divided by rank is bigger. And this is called a normalized churn curve. And you could put in a stability condition that could be easily verified by saying that if you take any subbundle or a certain subsheaf, the normalized churn class is no more than the original one. And that is the topological thing that one could verify. So this is a good example of using the inheritance, which is here, and some global condition to prevent the appearance of multiple ideal shapes, of non-trivial multiple ideal shapes. So here there is the inheritance of the D bar, inheritance of the total churn class. So we divide by the rank, you have the situation. This is the work of Donaldson and later Uhlenberg and Yao generalized to the Kähler case. But this point of view that I just discussed has never been written down in detail. I gave a series of lectures in Columbia about this, and Ben Weinkofer was a graduate student of Fong there, and he said it was interesting what kind of details. So we work out it under an additional assumption of finite generation of the multiple ideal shift, and it was published. But the complete case was never written up. When I have time, I'll tell you what is lacking there. If you are interested in working on this kind of thing, okay. I want to write my remark also in conjunction with this. There is a harder Narasimhan filtration. So you take a bundle, you can take a subbundle whose normalized churn cast is sort of maximum. So it's a destabilizing, a maximum destabilizing one. And then you take a quotient, and then you apply the same thing to a quotient. Therefore, you get a filtration, so that each quotient here does not have any destabilizer anymore because you have taken out the destabilizer. So it's known as semi-stable, which means it's direct sum of stable ones. Okay. And normalized trend cost of the quotient is a slightly decreasing function because you take out the maximal one and keep on going. This tells you that you have a handle on the culprit, so to speak. You can use this to sort of construct what I call echelon Hermitian Einstein metrics, because the original one, you don't have it. If you take these quotients, then of course they are semi-stable and direct sum are stable, and you could get the Cayley-Einstein metric. You get sort of like echelon or triangular situation. Okay? Of course, that's the best you could get. Now, go back to the Cayley-Einstein metric on final manifold. Since I put these two things together, they are sort of analogous. You ask, could you do the same thing for the final case? The trouble with the final case is nonlinear. It's not like collapsing a bundle on top of the base manifold, and then sub-bundle and so forth. You are collapsing a manifold. Of course, at the same time, you're collapsing the tangent bundle of the manifold. So it's nonlinear situation. Then you ask whether you could successively get so-called maximal destabilizing subspaces similar to Hardy-Narrow-Simon filtration, and the theory has not yet been developed. Then you want to say, perhaps you could construct this echelon Cayley-Einstein metrics. Okay. Now, even if you don't have the maximal one, if you keep on cutting down on a destabilizing subshift, you may get some echelon ones, and this has never been worked out either. Okay. This part actually would be essential also for construction of rational curves on final manifold without using characteristic P positive. Okay. Since I've been talking about theories not yet developed, I want to draw your attention to one problem that has been outstanding for a long, long time. It's the global deformation of Cayley manifolds. If you have a holomorphic family of compact complex manifolds, so that when T is not zero, T is an element in the disk. This is a unit open one disk. And when T is non-zero, the fiber is the same irreducible compact Hermitian symmetric manifold. You ask whether the fiber at the origin is also such a thing. Now, if you don't know much about irreducible compact Hermitian symmetric manifolds, they are like the projective space. They are like the hyperquadric. That means the hypersurface defined by a homogeneous polynomial of degree 2. And they are like Grassmannians. So historically, a long time ago, Hitzebrock and Kodara asked about Cayley manifolds diffeomorphic to Pn, whether it's equal to Pn. The odd case was done by them. And the even case was done by Yao, I think, after the Calabi conjecture. And now let's go back to this question. I did something. I did it for projective scale. My student Huang did it for the hyperquadric a long time ago. And if you assume that the fiber at the origin is Cayley, then Huang and Mox is my student. Nato actually is also my student. So it's just, I guess I can only talk about things that I'm familiar with. So fortunately, those are by people more associated with me. So it doesn't mean to be a commercialist. they show that if you assume the initial fiber is Cayley, then it's okay. So then the question is whether so-called global deformation of Cayley is Cayley, and that is still open. I want to make one remark and link it to multiple ideal sheaves. So it's known that small deformation of Cayley or local deformation of Cayley is Cayley that was done by Kodai and Spencer in 1960. And it's done by the so-called DD bar complex instead of D bar complex. You take the 0-0 form, that means functions, and take dd bar of that, and then the usual d, which is the sum of d and d bar. And the elliptic operator is obtained by going back by the edge join and apply the original operator and original operator and going back by the edge join. So this is the elliptic operator. This is the process of Friedrich and Duff's answer. And now this is the elliptic operator. And the Taylor problem is to show that the harmonic, the space of harmonics with respect to this operator is constant. So the local deformation is proved by Kodaira and Spencer by showing that the harmonic subspace, the subspace of things that are annihilated by this, the well-run form, is constant along the fibers. Okay. And that actually comes from ellipticity, but the trouble with the global deformation is that there's an edge joint here. The edge joint depends on the Kähler metric. And if you have only a Kähler metric before you get to the limit, you don't have ellipticity all the way. And before you get to the limit, where do you get your Kähler metric? It's from the irreducible Cumber-Hermitian symmetric manifold, right? A projective space. The Fubini-Sudi metric, for example. Of course, the trouble is Fubini-Sudi metric is not unique. When you take by holomorphism, it just moves around. So it's difficult to select one which converges. So when you do not have that, then you use the theory of multiple ideal sheaves and look at the stability question. And of course, you have the stability subsheave and so forth. And then you say, how are we going to prove that it doesn't exist? You know that differentiation holds the key, as I explained before. You just differentiate to get rid of the vanishing order. And there are a lot of vector fields around because it's a compact Hermitian symmetric. And then you say, well, they are not in the initial fiber, they are nearby. Doesn't matter because you can take a Hermitian metric in the background and normalize the vector fields with respect to it and just use a normal family and get to the limit, you get a vector field. Okay. And in general, it involves rescaling the vector field to make a unit norm. And then the Lie algebra loses its semi-simple property. That's actually the main trouble. Okay. So this part is still open, and I mentioned it so that people who are interested could look at it. Okay. So the significance here, I want to explain this. I mean, these things, even though are special situations, they are introduced for some reason. They are guiding examples. So by solving them, you will develop techniques which will be useful. And what are the situations being used? Okay. Now, we are interested in developing multiple ideal sheaves or general PDE system. So we discussed two PDE systems. One is the case of the funnel. Another case is the Young-Mills field. And now this case of the global deformation of Kähler metrics. And then another one that we use a lot to look at is the complex Norman problem, which I'm going to discuss a bit later. So in this case of the global deformation, this is a fourth order differential operator, and we want to use it as a guide to develop theory. And then you say, what is there to develop? Several ingredients. First ingredient is how to define multiplier ideal sheaf. Philosophically, you know that you stick in a multiplier in a crucial estimate. Okay. The question is, which is the crucial estimate you want to stick your multipliers in? And what is the best way of defining it? Of course, you want to get a recipe for a certain differential system so that when you give me a differential system, you look at symbols, I can tell you where to stick in the multiplier. So you want a good theory. Second, the inheritance of the differential structure on the destabilizing subsheaf. How do you get hold of that? We have some special situation, inheritance of the differential system. In the case of Fano, in the case of Hermitian Einstein, is a D bar and so forth. In the case of complex Neumann, we also know what it is. And in general, it's not clear what it is. And I want to use these examples to develop things. Okay. Now, another thing is that you want to make sure that the multipliers do not exist, or non-trivial multipliers do not exist. How do you handle it? Well, you look at compact Hermitian symmetric manifolds. The case of projective space, the case of Hubble quadrate were solved. Okay. And the rest would be of rank at least 2. The rank 1 is the projective space we solved. Even Hubble quadrate is not rank 1. The higher rank has the following property, that it has certain flat directions. So there are certain flat directions, that means certain curvature, bisectional curvature is zero in certain flat directions. And the flat directions are not integrable, they sort of crisscross. And they make everything rigid, like a scaffold. Okay. And that actually is the reason why Margulis proved super rigidity, managed to prove it super rigidity and arithmeticity or irreducible lattice in semi-similar groups of rank at least 2, because of the scaffolding, because of these set directions. They actually help you. Okay. So when you get the PDE system, they are going to help you also, but nobody knows at this point how to make use of it. Then you ask how the Margulis make use of it. Margulis went to the uniformization and looked at the ergodic action at the boundary, you know, on a billion dynamics on the boundary. Okay, which is more complicated than the usual abelian dynamics people talk about in complex dynamics when you iterate a single map, but these are nonlinear situations. Now, I want to give another example. Maybe I'm a bit behind time, so I think I'll stop and then reserve this for next time. I don't want to hold you up.